Energy up! This week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, sponsored by Campaign Cabinets!
There's going to be a new SRD.
But we're going to keep the old one.
The D&D Beyond Marketplace, microtransactions and a la carte purchases are out!
I can see why people are mad about it, but it seems like it's almost caught on as a meme.
Wizards of the Coast have centralized their opinion on AI art.
Look, I think that's just a wise business move.
James, you gotta watch Fallout. Come on.
Even that's I all.
Anyway,
it,
moving
that's
on.
It?
that's all you weren't even gonna spoil me?
All that and more right now. That's good. Good, 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 good. Yeah, good.
Hello, everybody.
Energy, energy, energy up.
Energy Hello, everybody.
Up. Sorry.
You know what? Joey, you do it this week. I've been interrupted. I'm going to my trailer.
Hello and welcome to the Eldritch Lorecast. This week we have our usual people. We've got Sean Merwin, we've got Dale Kingsmill, and we've got our host Ben Byrne, who I am covering for because he has been emotionally damaged by too many interruptions. And I'm James Hake. And for our opening question this week, I hand it back to you, Ben, now that the hard work has been done. Go back to hosting our beloved show.
Thank you, James. Thank you for the introduction. The question that I have for you this week.
Energy up!
Sorry. is, if you could write for a game system in an SRD, OGL type kind of situation, what system would it be? That system might already have an OGL, like Call of Cthulhu kind of has their open universal game playing tabletop system of awesomeness. But I don't know if, like, for example, Vampire Masquerade does. If you could, any system, doesn't have to be a finished system, could be in playtest. I'm taking too long to ask this question. James Hake, what's your answer?
I'd do it in Daggerheart. I'm really excited about Daggerheart. I keep getting excited about Daggerheart. You know, when the new playtest stuff comes out, I just want to mess around with it, you know? It's the fantasy milieu that I love and feel comfortable enough with, right? Like I could do Cthulhu or Vampire or whatever, but I don't really know what makes that genre tick in the same way that I know what makes heroic fantasy tick. So my inquisitive brain just wants to get into what Daggerheart does.
Sean Merwin, what about you?
Candyland, Ben. I want to make a Candyland role-playing game. I always threaten my class that I'm going to make them create a role-playing game using only the components and the board from Candyland. And I think it would be awesome.
That sounds incredible. We don't have Candyland as a standard sort of board game here, but I've seen imagery and I want that game.
Yeah, so, I'm not going to lie. I was nodding politely. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm sure. That sounds like
yes,
a thing. Yes,
Candyland.
A lot of people say that Candyland is not a game. A lot of contrarians like to call Candyland not a game because it doesn't have like player choices, right? You spin the spinner or you draw the card, you get your number, and you move to that next space. But I'd be really curious to see, like, I don't know, Candyland as like a die rolling system where it's like if you land on such and such space, right? Because there's special squares in Candyland, right? Mm-hmm. There's like the sure. There's the Prince Pudding or whoever.
Gumdrop Mountains and
Gloopy. Lord Licorice. Yeah. You know, you land on those guys. And, you know, that causes something to happen. Or you land on this color square and something happens. I don't know. I like your idea, Sean.
Thank you.
It's got me intrigued.
Energy up!
Dale, with the most energy, what game would you choose? What would you like to develop for?
I know that it's been my answer for a lot of things recently. I think it's just showing where my internal genre compass is at the moment. But I think I would have a lot of fun doing that kind of thing for Vampire or Call of Cthulhu. I think that getting my fingies in that kind of genre would be, I don't know, really cool.
I agree with you. I think my problem, and they're well documented at this point with Vampire, is kind of the lore of Vampire Masquerade. It feels a bit too cosmopolitan. It feels a bit too human to me.
There's
in a weird way.
There's also just so much of it.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Whereas I would love to see like alternative campaign settings, if you will, in using the Vampire Masquerade rules to create a world of vampires and werewolves and different things.
Alternatively, yet another comic book superhero game.
Well, I have good news for all of you. You could do any of those things in the next iteration of the 5th edition D&D rules, because they have just announced in the last 6 hours or so, breaking news, that everything we already knew, actually, there's going to be a new SRD for the new rules coming along shortly after the core rule book's release, I believe. I actually haven't had a chance to read all of the information, so we're going to cut live to the field. Sean Merwin, our field reporter. Sean, what do you think about this news? Is there anything you can elaborate upon?
Acts like it's raining out there in the field.
It's almost... I think it's great. I think we knew it was coming, and it was announced sooner than we had imagined, so that's even better. We won't see the SRD until all of the books are out, so we're looking at 2025 for the SRD itself. But even then, it's a pretty quick iteration based on past SRDs and open gaming licenses, which often take like 2 years to come out. I think that assuages a lot of people's hesitation or worry. And it looks like we are going to not only have the new open gaming license and SRD, but we're going to keep the old one. So if you want to continue creating under the old CC SRD, you can certainly do so. The only bit of news was that they have put on hold getting other additions into the Creative Commons or into an open gaming license, which they had said they were going to work on, but they don't have the manpower to do that now. But it's still on their, it's still on the radar. So that's great news for everyone, anyone out there who wants to make stuff.
Have they said, because this is something that I was curious about, but wasn't able to scan their post on the D&D, I think it was on D&D Beyond, if I'm not mistaken, their kind of Q&A blog post about it. Is it SRD 5.2, as they're calling it, going to be in the Creative Commons?
James?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It sounds like it will follow the same path as the SRD 5.1. So, yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about the Creative Commons, right? Is that they essentially don't have to worry about maintaining the license or doing anything like that, right? They can create it. They can say, this is good. And we don't want to, you know, invest any more of our time in thinking about it anymore. So you deal with it now, which this kind of feels vindicating to me insofar as when the SRD crisis broke last year, you get the sense that they were like, this is more trouble than it's worth, right? We have bigger fish to fry when it comes to, you know, when it comes to our D&D bottom dollar. So if third-party publishers want this, if this is the price of maintaining sort of a happy community, whatever. This is not going to pull in the $1 billion that we want to get out of Baldur's Gate 4 or whatever. And to that, I say good, right? Isn't that what we're all here for? We're here to play some tabletop D&D, and they can print all the action figures they want if that's where they think their profit is coming from. I love it. I'm pleased as punch.
It's exciting for not just third-party companies, but also people wanting to break into the tabletop RPG space as writers. I went to the University of Melbourne yesterday, which is not our only university, but it is one of them. And it's the University of Melbourne, not the University of Melbourne, if you know what I mean, Dale. I spoke to a couple of students who are doing a unit on game design, and kind of talked about how, you know, 5e is a great, or rather the DMs Guild and DriveThruRPG are great places to go if you want to just start cutting your teeth in putting product out there, in designing something. It can be big, but also can be very small. A class, a subclass, a collection of magic items, a few monsters, you know, 4 pages of something. So I think that it's not just a great resource for third-party companies to be able to produce hardback books. It's also a great way for people to kind of cut their teeth on getting into tabletop role-playing games, whether they stay in 5th edition or a version thereof, or they start there but then kind of start to find their own groove, you know, elsewhere. So, yeah, good news all around. Speaking of news,
I say energy up.
It is Cosmic Postman pointing out in the chat. It is worth clarifying for anybody who doesn't know yet. So SRD 5.1, referring to 5e 2014. The new SRD is 5.2, referring to 5e 2024. It's not SRD 6.0 or 5e or SRD 5.5 or anything like that. It is 5.2.
And so as some websites were reporting, no, they are not calling D&D 2024, D&D 5.2. a couple of websites like, hey, they've named the new edition. It's D&D 5.2. We're like,
but maybe we the people should name it 5.2.
You know what?
That's pretty funny.
Let's not. Let's call it Candyland.
Oh, Milton Bradley is gonna get feisty over that one.
Speaking of getting feisty, the D&D Beyond Marketplace has gotten a little feistier and less feisty in two directions. They've updated the marketplace on D&D Beyond. This was the big ticket item before the news broke this morning about the SRD. As of April 30th, so these changes have already taken effect, microtransactions and a la carte purchases are out. No longer can you purchase individual little things from a source book, such as a magic item, a subclass, a monster, whatever it is. You used to be able to kind of break out purchases from larger books in that manner. Why purchase a $30 monster book when you can, or $40 monster book when you can pay $2 for the specific monster that you want from that book? Was the old way of thinking. The new way of thinking is that you just buy the whole book, I guess.
I am not wrong. Legitimately shocked at how many people are not just mad about this. People being mad about things doesn't surprise me anymore, but by people who are in the replies to today's announcement about the updated SRD, about, you know, the open source rules revamp, being like, yeah, that's great and all, but what about our a la carte purchases? And I'm like, whoa, this would have been groundbreaking news. Like, it feels like this is a sort of thing that, yes, I can see why people are mad about it, but it seems like it's almost caught on as a meme of like, oh no, we can't pay $2 for a subclass anymore. We're gonna yell about this. $2 for a subclass is a terrible deal, man. You're paying like, you know, 5% of the book's price for 1% of the book's
content.
It's a
terrible deal if you were going to buy more than one or two things. Because if you really are specifically only interested in like two subclasses that are there, like if you don't want the entire Theros setting, but you just want these backgrounds or whatever they've provided, then that is a good price to pay $40 instead of, did I say 40?
You did.
40, that's not a good price.
$4.
People, I meant $4-y-doos. Of my people.
You meant four USD. Dollary-doos are Australian currency.
The whole separate thing.
Yeah.
I meant $4. It's way better to spend, you know, $4 on this stuff than the whole book's price. But I am interested in, I suspect a lot of people are probably in a similar camp to me where it's like, that's great. I love that that's an option. I think that's a really good system to have in place. But did I or would I ever use it? No. So I wonder how many people don't actually utilize that function, which makes it, you know, ultimately not that worthwhile and makes it not much of a difference to make people buy the whole book, but down with the idea, because I'm down with the idea of paying for individual bits and pieces. But
I think that's actually the thing that confuses me most, is because I think of microtransactions as kind of a universally hated concept among gamers, but maybe
This is a different kind of microtransaction.
Right, this isn't like a Overwatch loot box where you have no control over what you're getting. It isn't even a skin shop. This is like, you could be buying this for full price if you wanted to, but yeah, I mean I can totally see where the outrage is coming from.
It's just like, are you buying in bulk? Because if you're buying in bulk, it's a much better price. Yeah. But if you only need one packet of noodles, what's the point?
It does fly in the face of the whole idea that with D&D Beyond, you're not just getting your books, you're getting a character builder that you can specifically build a character that you want to play, that your game master might say, your dungeon master might say, yes, you can do that, but you have to buy that so I can see it on your character sheet. It makes sense. The good news is, you aren't losing stuff you've already purchased. They're not going to take it away. You just won't be able to do it going forward. Can it be an inconvenience? Yes. So can a million other things in our lives. And so I understand the frustration. Is it worth memes about? Probably not.
You know, there's also content sharing. So a GM who has purchased certain content can share it with their players. content sharing can get a little bit confusing if it's kind of daisy chained. Like I'm in a campaign, so I have content that's shared with me, but I don't know just by searching D&D Beyond what I own and what's content shared with me. So sometimes I'll tell a player, oh yeah, just go look this up on D&D Beyond. You should be able to access it because I have access to it. And they don't, because I didn't realize that that piece of content is being content shared with me from another GM. So it is a convenience. And as Dante kind of pointed out to me, he was like, it's a bummer because the use case for him was, I want to play this subclass. I'm just going to go purchase this subclass because I want to play it in this game and I don't want to have to purchase the entire book. But kind of similar to the conversation that James and Dale are having, I wonder what the mood around this would be if the news was the inverse. If Wizards of the Coast were announcing, you can now purchase your subclass or your monster stat block for $2, whether everybody would be getting angry about the evils of microtransactions, you know?
They would. They totally would. There's no doubt.
Well, this is the sort of thing that makes me wonder if Wizards may have meant to do this from the beginning of the DDB acquisition, and they've just been too busy to get around to it. Because Curse, when Curse, then Fandom, made D&D Beyond, they had their own ideas about what made a good platform. And they often locked horns with Wizards over what the best approach to running their service was. And they sometimes just did stuff like putting up the Blood Hunter. I'm shocked the Blood Hunter is still up on there, to be totally honest. I thought that would have been Wizards like, get that crap out of here. This is not first party. But now they've got all sorts of third party stuff, so maybe not.
Just PS, while we're there, Michael in chat did bring up, are they maybe simplifying it because as they're introducing third party publishers, it's possible that those publishers don't want their things to be available for a la carte purchase. Is it just simpler in that case to just make it all the same?
Interesting. Was there ever any a la carte purchasing for Tome of Beasts, Monsters of Drakenheim, stuff like that?
Not that I know of.
No. Yeah. Okay.
I don't think so.
Interesting.
But you can now buy physical books through D&D Beyond, and you can purchase physical and digital bundles. I have no idea if that makes them both cheaper to do so, but you can do that through D&D Beyond.
Yeah, there is a discount if you buy the bundle.
It is worth mentioning, though, that is US only for the time being. You can't order physical books through D&D Beyond if you are located outside the US currently. And also, their product listings have just, like, frankly, improved. Includes more product info, content breakdowns of, like, how many monsters, how many magic items, how many subclasses. You can kind of see at a glance. Previews of content from inside the book, particularly art. So it's kind of, it looks a little bit more, not entirely comparable, but it looks a little bit more to, like, DriveThruRPG or DM's Guild in terms of showing a bit more about what you're actually purchasing before you make the purchase digitally. And apparently they have removed digital bundles such as the player bundle or sourcebook bundle that were there previously are no longer available.
One more thing to point out is that you cannot buy physical books of third-party content that's on D&D Beyond.
Okay.
So you couldn't get Layers of Aetheris, for example, as a physical, you know, you would have to go to the website for the individual companies to buy the physical.
Yeah, you know, where you can get Dungeons of Drakenheim physical, ghostfiregaming.com. And, you know, Tome of Beasts, I'm sure, as well, physically through the Cobalt Press website.
And Tal'Dorei Reborn on Griffle.com.
There you go. To the four corners, my friends. We will gather them all.
Three corners. I'm not part of this.
Okay. My apologies.
We're here to say anti-centralization when it comes to the internet. Go. Be free from your single
decentralization,
social media.
Anti-centralization. We aren't just decentralizing. We're explicitly destroying the centralized system.
Well, we never centralized in the first place. That's why you're opposed to the initial centralized. Speaking of centralizing, Wizards of the Coast have centralized their opinion on AI art into a single FAQ, which has been released. I believe this is on D&D Beyond as well, answering a couple of questions regarding their AI art policy in particular and how they will manage relationships with artists and the public going forward. The main points on this sort of being that D&D and Magic the Gathering will continue to not use AI art in the creation of their products. Artists are given a brand handbook with guidelines, including requirements to refrain from using AI creation tools. However, Wizards of the Coast will not always publicly discuss when an AI artwork has been alleged or detected in one of their products because they wish to protect the privacy of the artist as much as public interest. Especially in the case of false accusations, as we had happen, was that the start of this year or late last year, where the dwarf fighter from the new edition of D&D was accused of being AI art, which was proved, I believe, not to be the case in the end, and kind of shook that artist's career a little bit, if not personal life, as a result of the online furor. And I think that's perfectly respectable. Perfectly fine.
Wizards is a company that lives and dies by their art, as their statement said. And so they have a vested interest in protecting the livelihood and well-being of their artists, at least to the extent that they can continue working with them, right? At least to the extent that their artists do not piece out of the industry and make things difficult for Wizards. And so, you know, artists getting harassed on Twitter as part of an AI witch hunt, as many artists have used the term, that's not a term I'm coining here, seems like a smart idea. I think the funniest part of that statement is they're saying, like, we can't speak for all of Hasbro. They'll probably use AI, but Wizards of the Coast, we don't want to mess with that. Trivial Pursuit, yeah, they'll use AI all day.
Sure. Get ready for all the board game mascots to have too many fingers, yeah. But...
Michael J. Pastor asking, does this mean they're not going to credit artists publicly now? No, it does not mean that. It just means that they're not going to publicly discuss their investigations, I believe, when an AI art issue arises. The credits for artists will still be in the books. There's no individual credit on any of the art pieces inside of a book, but all artists are credited inside the front page of the book or on the credits page at the start of the book.
That hasn't been true for a while, actually. These days, artists are credited by name. It's just kind of hidden in the binding, in the gutter of the pages.
Oh, it's been a while since I've bought a physical Wizards of the Coast book, as you can tell.
Yeah, but if people don't remember the last time that we discussed this, there was we kind of had a whole discussion around the idea that when these accusations come up, the internet is reacting immediately, and that puts a lot of pressure on the company, the individual in question, whoever, to respond immediately. Mm-hmm. And so then you kind of have this buildup of potential misinformation because it's like, well, we can't leave it sit because everything's going to get worse while we're not saying anything. But at the same time, like in the last example, it wasn't true. And so you don't want to come out and say anything too quickly. And it all just becomes kind of, you end up with this cycle of the way that the crowd trains you to respond. So I think it's actually a very wise idea to just have a blanket statement out front right now and say, we're just not going to talk about it. When it happens, we'll investigate, we'll do whatever we need to do. This is our stance. We don't want anyone using AI. But when we investigate, we're just not going to talk about it in public. I think that's just a wise business move.
Also saying that Wizards of the Coast are being as transparent as they can be with the public with this situation, but also...
That's a really funny sentence. No, you're not.
But... As transparent as they want to be, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, they...
True transparency would be to say that.
Well, they do say in the fact, like when they're not going to address public accusations of the use of AI art, that is not a universal, we will never address it. They do say in the fact that they may address it if they feel it's relevant to do so, particularly if it's a case or a situation that has a lot of publicity on it. They're just saying that they won't do so if they don't feel that it's in the best interest of the artist. Or potentially themselves.
Or the organization that they are hiring to do marketing that uses a completely different set of artists who may then use AI art. And Wizards doesn't want to have to say, well, we work with Brand X Marketing and they have an AI policy, but they have an artist who broke those rules. So, you know, that's bringing far too many people out into the open for Wizards to have a relationship with that is productive. So, yeah, that's also part of it.
That's a really good read, Sean, because I remember something like that happening when Magic got embroiled in a AI art scandal, right? With all the little gears and levers and pressure tubes and stuff for that one Magic set.
Like literally the background image on the advertising assets for the cards. So the cards themselves weren't AI, but the,
And, you know, that was obviously made by some agency the Wizards had hired to deal with that for them. And AI is everywhere in ad agencies. I recently got a look at what art direction in advertising looks like these days. And the amount of AI in there just to meet deadlines, it boggles my mind.
Well, that being the situation as it is, speaking of incredible art, this week's sponsor of the Eldritch Lorecast is Campaign Cabinets, creating heroic monuments for your tabletop RPG miniatures. Have you, has anybody here created like a hero with Hero Forge, or they've, you know, found a GW miniature that they just thought, that's my hero, that's my character.
Oh yeah.
And then you play your campaign with them. And where do they end up usually?
In a bin somewhere.
I think mine's somewhere on the bookshelf.
Exactly.
Sorry. You say bins to mean garbage can. I mean bin to mean like a storage bin.
Oh, gotcha. In storage, out of sight. Yeah. Can't see them anymore. Their heroic deeds are not being paid tribute to. Well, what if you could, instead of throwing them in the garbage or a dark, dank storage place, commemorate their heroic deeds with one of Campaign Cabinets, decorative monument that I have here, which I'm sure Dante is also showing better images of on the edited version of this, it's like a plaque. It's like a monument that you can hang up. It shows a background image that reminds you of your campaign. This one's very, very vampire-y, very Barovia-ish, but it could also be Grimhollow. This could be something dedicated to Astoria. And there's a little spot down here where you place your miniature and you hang it up on your wall forever to be commemorated.
Really cool.
It's really cute.
This genuinely, because I watch with great envy Ryan Nimmel DM, who will occasionally upload little videos of like him making little sort of, I don't know, he's got the domed glass and he's got his little sort of terrain set up, and he puts a hero or an NPC there to like commemorate them after they've done this stuff. But that takes a lot of talent, time and money that I don't have. So this is perfect for me.
Yeah. When I checked out the Kickstarter, I was having trouble understanding the scale. And I thought, are these the coolest coffins ever? I'm down for this. And then I realized, it's to hold a mini. But for our groups, when we finish a campaign, we have an artist draw the party.
Sure.
And any memorable NPCs to hang up to remember the things we've done. And this is an absolutely wonderful way to do that, to hang on to those memories of your campaign. Yeah.
I agree entirely. I mean, I can imagine having like a wall of, you know, five of these in a circle, you know, or if you're just, you know, want to commemorate yours, if you're the miniature person in the party. There are on the Kickstarter deeper ones that you can put on a bookshelf instead.
I was just looking at that.
Which look really cool because it looks like your miniature's really in the scene of the campaign. The company's called Campaign Cabinets. They're currently running a Kickstarter where you can get your hands on one of these campaign cabinets to commemorate your miniature. I've thrown a link in the chat, but you can also check, it'll be that way, I think, if you check the link up there or down in the description. The Kickstarter's only got, I think, about 7 days left, 6 days left if you're hearing this on YouTube, maybe 8 or 9 days if you're live with us here on Twitch. So go check it out. They're a super cool company. They're just a small independent company as well. I think it's just a couple of dudes throwing these things together, a couple of passionate artists, and they look super cool. So go check them out.
Good stuff.
Speaking of good stuff, James, you got to watch Fallout. Come on.
I'm missing the good stuff.
You're missing the good stuff. Anyway, moving on.
You weren't even going to spoil me? I'd accept a spoiler at this point. I'm behind.
Have you seen it, Sean? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Do you enjoy it?
So much. I never played any of the video games, and my wife watched it with me, and I thought, she's might not like this. We were both into it the whole time, and
Right.
I am not surprised that the Fallout TV show has caused the tabletop role-playing game to sell out, Ben. Did you know that?
It sold out?
I didn't know there was a Fallout TTRPG at all. What?
Mm-hmm. Wow, you are behind.
I am behind.
There is a tabletop role-playing game for Fallout done by Modiphius with their 2D20 system. And the surge in popularity after the series came out saw month-to-month sales double across all Fallout products, a massive spike in web traffic. And so the core TTRPG books and the starter set called Wasteland Warfare are both sold out now, but they will be restocking and expect within weeks. And you can also pre-order, which I might do because I think I might be able to get my wife to play the Fallout RPG thanks to the series. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I did go have as a tabletop war gamer, I went and had a look at Wasteland Warfare. I also looked at the Fallout board game by Fantasy Flight. I don't know if it's still in print, but you can still get it. It's definitely still around. The role-playing game I had heard of previously as well. So it's exciting. It's exciting for Modiphius. It's exciting for Fallout. It's exciting for Bethesda, I'm sure.
I was running a 2D20 Star Wars game at Origins last year, and next to me, they were running a 2D20 Fallout game, and I could just hear them, you know, over there playing, and it just sounded like they were having so much fun with the way that this game mimics not just the video game, but the world that Fallout presents to us. And I'm definitely interested in playing it now.
Makes sense.
It's a really good sell because I never played the video games, but now I'm like,
Do I sense a Fallout 5 play coming on?
I mean, yeah, given how based on TTRPGs the like Fallout 1 and 2 games were, and honestly, even the later Bethesda ones, right, with their perks and stats and stuff like that, I get it.
Yeah.
It seems like it was a video game custom made to be adapted to TTRPGs.
It is a really, like, I'm playing Fallout 4 at the moment off the back of the TV series. I went and downloaded that. I kind of grappled with myself which Fallout to play. I'm sorry, New Vegas fans. You were kind of the hipsters of the Fallout fan base, I'm going to say. But I just don't think Fallout New Vegas is that much more special than the others. I said it. So I'm playing Fallout 4 at the moment, mainly because it's the most modern one, I'm not going to lie, and I don't need to rely on VATs to shoot things. But it is a role-player's role-playing game where I'm like this guy who's gone, who's from the modern day, from the past, from like before the bombs fell. I get frozen, I come back out, the world's gone insane, but I'm an ex-soldier and I'm an ex-medic. I don't want to hurt anybody, but everybody keeps shooting at me. And so I'm kind of like this slow evolution, almost like Walton Goggins' character from the TV show, this slow evolution. Don't worry, James, I'm not spoiling anything. From a, you know, I suppose all American, but maybe what I mean is just like genuine, nice person who wants the best for the world. And devolves into this kind of almost, in Walton Goggins' case, like bounty hunter ghoul. In my character's case, kind of like the sheriff of the wasteland is the way that I'm seeing myself, but have gone from like, I hope that I don't have to hurt anyone and I just want to help put the world back together, to sometimes to save the world, you got to break it apart a little bit more. And it's it is a role player's role playing game in the video
one
game.
One day,
sense,
Ben, so. I want to see you play a character who is just a genuine optimist. Like, that's the core element of their character that cannot change.
My character believes they're an optimist in the context of Fallout.
Could you say okie dokie, Ben?
Okie dokie.
That's exactly how I see that coming. Yeah.
I'm a sheriff
of the wasteland. But, you know, it's fascinating to have seen this happen for Fallout in the way that it has. The TV show is obviously fantastic. This, you know, Stranger Things is largely credited in part for the massive success of 5th edition from back in the day. These are not the only two successes we've seen. Cyberpunk, I believe, had its own renaissance, especially on the video game side. I'm sure it did on the tabletop RPG side when that cartoon series hit Netflix. I would not be surprised to see more tabletop RPGs that have IP behind them clambering to see if they can get a TV show, because it just seems to just blow up the popularity of whatever it is. Assuming it's good, you know, Halo notwithstanding.
That feels like that classic thing if they were to do that, that feels like that classic thing of misunderstanding why something is popular.
Sure.
Or why something worked. And it's like, well, we just do that exact same thing again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Many of the conversations I've had with some of the 18 to 25 gamers I know, they insist that their generation is done with media that they can't interact with. And they want to insert themselves, whether they're watching a show and wanting to chat about it while they watch, or wanting to play the role-playing game to put themselves into the world that they're interested in. And I have seen no evidence to contradict that claim that I've heard from countless now, you know, gamers and fantasy science fiction fans of that era.
Yeah, I remember back when we had a SNES emulator on our computer when I was a kid. Nintendo, please don't arrest me. And we had, it was Dragon Ball Z Hyperdimension, I want to say was the name of the game. And it was just a side-on combat game where you would play characters from Dragon Ball Z. And I was a huge Dragon Ball Z fan at the time. And there was something so special about feeling like I could interact with that world and that it was me. There's a lot of criticism for video games in particular, especially linear video games like, you know, maybe The Last of Us, where there's no real narrative choice in it. It's a story that plays out in front of you, but you're interacting with it. Is that any different from a TV show that you can't really change the narrative in, even though you're interacting with it? And I contend yes, because it feels more personal. You did the things that Joel did in The Last of Us 1, you know, and not everybody agrees with that. Some people felt a disconnect because they would have chosen something different at the end of that game. But I think that there is exactly like you said, Sean, as soon as you finish watching Fallout, the TV series, you're like, how can I experience that world? How can I make the choices in that world? How can I write my version of what that TV show would be?
A lot of these types of people would really enjoy writing fan fiction if they just gave it a go.
I agree with you.
This form of interacting with media has been around forever.
And they do. And they do. But it's just a next step in that evolution of interaction, because you can interact not just with the world on the page, but with people in the world. I think they're coming to find out that this role-playing games have been around for, well, since 1974 or earlier, and it's ready-made for them to just step into this.
I think that's right. I think that fan fiction, and I haven't done a lot of fan fiction specifically, but I obviously do a lot of writing. It is a dialogue with yourself, and it is a dialogue with characters, right? Sometimes it feels like the characters make their own decisions when you realize, I can't write it this way. This character wouldn't do that. I have to do this instead. But it doesn't, the world doesn't push back at you, I don't think, in the same experience, or not as tangibly, or not as instantly for someone who isn't a writer, when they experience it in a video game or a role-playing game form, when you have someone else across the table from you kind of, you know, giving back, giving the world back.
Certainly the immediacy of it is not there. Yeah.
Yeah. RIP Halo. Anyway, I haven't even watched season two. Was it good? Did anybody watch it?
Ben, are you going to watch the season three of The Witcher?
Season four, you mean? I watched season
three. Oh, right. Yeah. Season four. Are you going to watch it now that Cavill is out?
Morbid curiosity will compel me to watch it, but it has not been good since the first episode of the second season. And from there, it was absolute trash. I've watched the first season like three or four times. I've watched the second season once through, and then I tried to watch it a second time before season three dropped, and I got three episodes in, and I was like, oh, no, that's right. This is garbage. and then season three, was 90% trash.
Can I say a shocking and terrible thing? I didn't really like season one.
That's not that shocking or terrible.
Okay, great. Good.
Yeah,
I liked a lot of things about season one.
I liked a lot of concepts, but not how they were used.
In what way?
Visually fun, good. I like the concept of throwing us in the deep end with kind of like what part of the timeline is this in, you know? God. I like that idea, but I don't think that that was actually done well, because I don't think that there was any technique utilized to make the audience go, oh, okay, we are like, you were really reliant on, did you see this specific character in this episode or whatever to figure out where in the timeline it came. And that was, I found it not even confusing. It was just kind of like difficult to get your bearings. It was like, I understand what's going on, but you've made me work really hard for something that shouldn't have been hard work.
Yeah.
And I love time travel stories, so I don't feel like this is a me issue.
It's interesting because Ciri is a character who ultimately becomes someone with sort of time and space powers, right? And so to kind of disorient us in time like that is a really interesting bit of like almost immersive storytelling. But it's like it's for the wrong part of the story. Ciri does not have that ability or that awareness yet. She'll get it later. And it'll be really compelling later, but like, why'd you do it now?
Yeah. And I'm down to be disoriented, but I want to at least be notified that I'm disoriented rather than having to figure that out on my own.
Or have a reason to be disoriented. If you do this jumping in time thing, it's generally to put not the events in the correct order, but the theme. Growing in a certain way.
Yes.
And as you said, I finally realized they're jumping around in time, but it didn't add anything for me thematically or plot-wise even. It just seemed to be like, okay, we're going to move around in time. And as you said, Dale, no sort of rhyme or reason to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think the reason is that Lauren Hisrich, the showrunner, said that the challenge for them was they saw the story as a story of three people, Geralt, Ciri, and Yennefer, but their individual stories do not happen concurrently. So it was like the reason for the time jumping was completely meta. It was completely practical to being able to tell their three stories concurrently rather than focusing on, you know, Geralt for a while and then Yennefer for a while and then Ciri kind of coming in as a concept right towards the end. Because if you read the short stories, Ciri's not in it until the end of the second book, I think, which is a collection of short stories. And I think that the essence of what makes The Witcher cool as a concept, for me at least, I think there's other parts of that world that are cool, but the idea of this almost tradesperson who wanders around, hunts monsters for a living, knows the truth of the superstitions, you know, people like, oh, there's a dragon up on the hill and he's going to break my house apart.
I really wanted more monster hunting. Well, I came in really wanting monster hunting vibes and it happened like three times.
Those are the best episodes, you know, the Striga episode, the first episode I think is really good. That's why the first episode of the second season is good, because it's based on a short story and it's kind of a monster hunt style thing. And, you know, even playing the video game. Do you like monster hunting, Ben? Yeah, you know what, James? I love monster hunting so much. You can check out the Grim Hollow Monster Hunter 5e class now in playtest. I'll put a link down in the description, or you can check it out up there if you want to play a Witcher-style character. I love monster hunting. It's the best part of the show. And unfortunately, everything else kind of fell apart around the edges. Anyway, that was your impromptu Witcher watch.
Witcher watch, the Watchers of Witches.
All right, I'm going to group these two questions together. These two listener questions, Sean, where would they have sent them?
They would send those, Ben, to podcast@ghostfiregaming.com.
Excellent, excellent. And
.com.
Peter and Craig both sent these questions. I apologize to both Peter and Craig. These questions were sent like right at the start of the year, but I felt like we were a little fatigued on the AI art discussions at that point. But now that it's relevant again with the recent FAQ released, we're going to tackle these. Peter asking first, as a small independent creator, mostly on DriveThruRPG and DMs Guild, purchasing art can be prohibitively expensive. To give the full context, Peter, you know, creates content that they want to publish through DriveThruRPG. The only kind of recompense they get from that is the couple of dollars that people choose to spend on it on DriveThruRPG. Peter's completely self-written. It's all his own time. So he's not working with a team or anything like that. But getting art into a piece, I mean, this is known that if you can visually stand out on a marketing platform like, or marketplace platform is what I mean, like DriveThruRPG, you're far more likely to attract an audience. But Peter's not likely to remake the, you know, hundreds of dollars that it can cost to have bespoke art made. So in that specific circumstance of maybe not even overly specific circumstance, but in that circumstance of someone who's not likely to be able to recoup the cost of their art in the first place to repay themselves, let alone the artists, is it okay to use AI art?
Do we scissors, paper, rock for who gets to go first?
Both, like this question and the other email we got this week about AI, I could write an entire like college dissertation about, man. Dale, you go first.
You sure?
Yes, I'm okay. If we get to the second one, that's the one I'm really, really compelled by.
Okay. So I fully get where you're coming from. And I think we're going to end up touching on similar points in some places. First of all, I would like to say that AI is a tool, like any technology, any technological advancement is a tool, and that doesn't make it good or bad, but it does need regulation. You know, cars themselves are not good or bad, but we do need to regulate the use of cars. And I think that we need to be talking about regulation right now, because we're in a place where, yes, you can get very reasonable, good case uses out of AI, but it's still in a position where it is harming other people, right? It is taking the work of hardworking artists, and it is scraping it out of their hands and handing it to you. And I don't think that, certainly I'm not here to say you as a DM or a creator for the DMs Guild, you shouldn't be able to utilize this tool that makes your life easier. But I do think that the reason we fight for regulations right now is because there are ways in which you can have access to that, but it is in a form that doesn't hurt people. If we get the regulations in place now that say AI systems have to use approved art, people have to like volunteer their art, choose to upload their art to these databases. If we say artists get a cut of revenue from these companies that create the AI systems, then you still get that thing that you want that lets you make your bespoke art. But at the same time, the artists aren't being completely screwed over, right? So that's why there's such a push right now for regulation in AI. I think AI is here to stay, absolutely. And that, you know, it's going to be something that we have to reckon with, and we can't just shut out completely and never use. But I think that if we push really hard now, that's where we can try to have it used in a way that is more, I don't know, grounded in humanity is the phrasing that I feel compelled to use right now. The other thing I want to say, DMs Guild it's a really tricky situation. I completely get it, because art is a big way that you stand out on that platform. And if you can't afford artists, you're in a tricky spot. You know, the Wizards of the Coast will let you use their art packets that they have there. Here, use official Wizards of the Coast art and your stuff. But it's all woefully outdated, not remotely organized in a way that you can navigate. It's basically impossible. But you know what? As someone who's published, frankly, I'm going to come out and say it, some very good looking, you know, items for sale up at the DMs Guild. I didn't go and contract an artist. I couldn't afford that. I went digging through public domain art. I went digging through stuff from the late 1800s, okay? As long as someone died before 1950, an artist died before 1950, you're pretty safe to use their art. Go looking for stuff, because there's so much stuff that you can find that you can tailor to fit your fantasy style setting, and that will actually, in many ways, mimic the kind of art that is used in official Wizards of the Coast D&D products right now. You can really, if you knuckle down and do that, you can do that for free. So I get that it is hard, but I think we're at a crucial point where we really need to be putting in that work and pushing for regulation of this kind of technology.
Before we get to the second question, I just want to add a couple of things. One, as Dale said, you can go to lots of different websites. Just do a search of free RPG art, and there are royalty-free Creative Commons, all sorts of places out there. It's not going to be the exact piece of art that you want, but it will be close enough that it will be visually pleasing to those people who are triggered to buy something by visually pleasing. The second thing I want to say is, whether you put up a work on the DMs Guild right now that is full of art or bereft of art, it's not going to make a lot of money anyway. I'm sorry to be the one to have to say that, but we're to the point now where it is just overloaded. Can you make money? Absolutely. But the people that are making the money are putting out the 100-page plus fully custom art books that they can afford to. So keep that in mind. Don't think, even if you use AI art and you make a beautiful book, that it's going to sell just because you have art in it. The marketplace is a little rough right now there.
I think this question also applies just very quickly to people who are in, like if they've got a Patreon or something like that set up as well. I think DM's Guild is the example rather than the definitive. James, do you want to jump in or do you want me to introduce the second question first?
Yeah, I have stuff I could add about this, mostly about the role art plays to kind of follow off of what Sean said. But I think between Dale and Sean, you both covered this really excellently. There's not much more I could add to this topic, so I don't need to opine.
The second question, which I'm curious to know if thoughts change at all here, comes from Craig asking AI tools for GM session prep specifically, non-commercial, non-public use, just kind of private use in your home game. GM tools, AI art can be used to very quickly make visually interesting maps, visually interesting, region maps or dungeon maps, or even art of a BBEG or an art of a monster. Players can use AI to create art of their player character very quickly and very efficiently. And it's not something that they're trying to sell elsewhere. It's just something that they're doing entirely for themselves. What do you feel about that?
This is a really compelling question. The private usage question about generative AI, whether that is, generating plot hooks via ChatGPT to aid in your DMing, or to generate battle maps or NPC portraits or anything like that using any of the number of AI generative illustration tools like Midjourney, etc. Listen, before I go into this answer, you got to know that I'm pretty hardline about being anti-AI, but I hope that my opinion on this will at least help you understand why I believe in that. Why I think that using AI in your home games is maybe not necessarily as ethically bad as using it in a published product, but is still a net negative for your game. And there's kind of two main arguments that I use for talking about published AI art, and one is ethics, which I think we covered pretty well in the last question, which just in summary is this is laundered plagiarism, right? It's scraping art or text or whatever output you want from web-based input, and it is putting it through a machine, and it is using that algorithm to turn out something. It costs artists jobs, and it essentially makes it easier for people who make a lot of money at the top of big companies to sharpen deadlines, lower budgets, etc. It hurts working artists. There's also the environmental argument. Just like NFTs and cryptocurrency were roundly criticized for using daily the amount of energy of a small developing nation, the energy cost, the environmental cost of using generative AI is worse. If you look up AI energy costs, you will see that major AI companies are talking about how ultimately expansion in this industry is untenable without a breakthrough in, say, fusion technology, right? We don't have enough energy on the planet Earth to make mass adoption of AI feasible. And if you are even mildly environmentalist, that should concern you, whether it's being used on industrial scale or on a home scale. But I want to talk about a third thing here, Craig, because I want to know why you want to use this tool, right? Does it make your life easier because you want to create new plot hooks? Does it make your life easier because you want battle maps really fast? You want it exactly like you see it in your head? Because I really want you to ask yourself if it actually improves your game to be using this tool. If you had this idea of, you know, a goblin fortress in your head for a battle map, you wanted that. And hey, you don't just want a battle map. You want a sort of establishing shot like you might see in a movie to show your players, have them, you know, like go, whoa, that's so cool. When you show it to them, do you need that? Right. I personally think if your home groups are anything like mine, that your friends will love your hand drawn scribble of a battle map just as much, if not more, as a beautifully rendered, shiny, full color, pristine AI generated map. And to be perfectly honest, they don't need the high production value establishing shot that you also want to give them. It would be extremely, extremely cool for you to show it to them. But it is just as cool, the fact that you're running a D&D game at all. And that level of production value will be generated in their heads, right? Even if you use battle maps, this is a theater of the mind, imaginative game. The only reason why you would need, you know, capital and need presentational resources like that is if you're running a big live play game, or if you're Critical Role or Dimension 20 or something like that. And that gets us into the publication argument again. Your game will be just as cool and just as fun if you use those tools or if you don't. And to be perfectly honest, if you want really high quality battle maps, I would really think it would be better to support an artist on Patreon that does stuff like that. It won't be exactly what you want in your head. That's 100% true. And it may require some work for you to hunt through the database or the archive of what their art is. But that art that you find will be more thoughtful and more interesting than the sort of middle ground level stuff you'll get out of an AI algorithm.
Because once again, it's the same thing that comes up with every artist versus AI thing ever. It's that this is a person who has, over a long period of time, trained. They have experience in knowing what makes a map good or not good, whereas the AI is just going to kind of look for patterns, right? Mm-hmm. But someone who's been doing this for years isn't just drawing a map like I would draw a map. They're going, okay, but what would make this terrain interesting? What would be a fun obstacle? What's some fun, like, background clutter that will add to the story of this place? Also, everything you just said, but like the pessimistic flipped view of it as well. Your players are unappreciative heathens, and it makes no difference whether I have scribbled a map in the moment or if I've taken like a full 2 days to draw the most beautiful watercolored map in the world. They react no differently. If I put down an index card with the word goblin written on it versus putting down an exquisitely painted, beautifully crafted miniature, they don't care. They've never said anything different.
I played a game online last year, and the DM would say, now, hang on a second, and up would pop a piece of art, AI art that he had created to show this magic item or this monster or this NPC. And all it did for me was cringe the hell out of me as I said, oh, God, he's using AI art. It's the Walmart in the U.S. It's the Walmart problem, right? We can accept it. Well, we're going to fight it. Well, we'll accept it little by little. Oh, I'm just using it for my home game, and it becomes a little more accepted. Oh, I'm just using it for this free product, and it becomes a little more acceptable, until we're just accepting it. And then large publishers are doing it to, as Dale said, cut down on production time, take away jobs. But we've now let it in. We've let it out. We've accepted it on these scales, and then it becomes, well, now we're getting lots of bonuses for our executives and lots of buybacks for our shareholders because we didn't stop it when we could.
And as somebody, I think, pointed out in the chat earlier, and for the record, I don't know this is true, but I would imagine there's some truth behind this idea that AI companies would get more investment based on user base. So even if you're using the AI thing for personal use, it's a contribution to you know, the overall user base that would gain more. You know what? I'm making up words.
It's an Australian word, Dale.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I wouldn't know. Yeah,
yeah, you're it's a regional to Victoria, you know, to the good state. I won't continue with Australian beef jokes. Anyway,
I feel like New South Wales just implicitly won, but go on.
We've got a comment in chat that that's from J Pizza Beats. It says, "The less detailed art is, the more I can imagine the coolest version of what's being described in my head." And I 100% agree with that.
Thank you, James. Thank you for rescuing us.
Because I remember playing 8-bit and 16-bit video games when I was a kid. And all of those low res, low poly games gave me so much room to imagine that what was happening was a lot cooler than it actually was. And there was this sort of time period, this slump in between really highly stylized graphics and modern hyper realistic graphics, or, you know, properly hyper stylized graphics, right? That everything just kind of looked bad and empty and dull. And it's because, you know, it's gotten realistic enough that you can take it at your own merits, but also, you know, there's nothing of real substance happening underneath it. And that's exactly where AI is. And even though I tend to avoid saying, you know, AI is not worth it because it, you know, it has too many fingers or it looks bad. AI isn't bad because it looks bad, but AI being overly busy, filled with too many details, distracts the eye. It misses, you know, what's really good about art. And it's not that it's full of flashy colors and, you know, it has the guy doing the thing in it that you want to do. It's because it, you know, it directs your eye using craft, right? It creates interesting images, not just busy ones.
There's a reason why so many AI systems still, you fill in a prompt and they give you a number of options to choose from. It's because the human is still better at telling what actually looks good.
Yeah. I think Adam Savage, of all people, I was watching just one of his YouTube videos where he answers questions and he got asked about AI art. And the thing that crystallized the uncanniness of AI art for me was something he said about AI art lacks a point of view. And that's kind of something that I think is easier. Well, no, I don't actually think this, but it's something that's more telling in AI art than it having five fingers or six toes or whatever. It's getting better and better to the point where a lot of the time there's not necessarily many technical issues in it, or it's at least gotten to the point where it's hard to tell if AI art or artists just made a mistake, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you generally, when you're looking at AI art, it's very flat, polished, glazed in a way that it lacks a point of view. It lacks an opinion on its own subject, which is very ephemeral and probably very subjective anyway. But I think that it is true.
Watch an episode of Star Trek from the 60s, right? Those Star Trek episodes are full of arguments where they're like, it's the human emotion, Spock, that makes all the difference. And it's like, that's what AI is lacking, you know? It's like, even when it looks gorgeous, art says something. Art says something. And your MS Paint drawing of a battle map will say something. And it will say something really, really unique, right? You will get some generic slop that your players will forget about in a session or less, when you get it generated off of an algorithm. But I have had people talking about the little goof ups I make when I'm drawing my MS Paint maps in Roll20 or whatever for literal years following that. And that's the joy of TTRPGs, is the connection with your friends.
You know what's also interesting? So there's chat going on as well in the chat, of all places. Who could have guessed? About the idea that artists train for a very long time to know what looks good, but specifically why something looks good, whereas a layperson doesn't necessarily understand why one thing looks better than another thing. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of something I was reading recently where a person works as kind of, you know, the art manager for this game company or whatever. And they were told, we're going to be accepting, we're looking at not just these artists, but also these prompters who use AI to generate art. And so they got in the first round of art. Okay, here we go. And they were like, okay, the stuff from the prompters isn't that bad. And they asked for corrections. And the prompters could not make corrections to the artwork.
Right.
And so they you know, kept trying to coax them through it and say, no, I don't want you to change the entire, because every time it kind of came back as an entirely different image. And they're saying, no, I want it like that first image, but I want this, this, and this tweaked. And I want, you know, this composition to be changed. And I want these things. But it was something that the AI and also the people who were utilizing the AI were not capable of implementing. And so in the end, the company, according to this story, just that those were, you know, the people who were first dropped from this potential pool of artists that they were working with, not even because they were against using AI, but because it just wasn't up to scratch really when it actually came down to the processes involved.
Indeed. Well, speaking of lacking things, what we currently lack is time. Because this podcast needs to come to an end, because it always does, sadly, or not sadly, because we need to eat and sleep and do other things. Anyway, if you've enjoyed it, this podcast, you can join us live. You can join in the chat. If you join us on Twitch at Ghostfire_official, twitch.tv/Ghostfire_official, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on a Monday, 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on a Monday, Tuesday, 9 a.m., wake up with the Eldritch Lorecast, your morning radio show at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday. Well, I always butcher these. Anyway, or check us out on YouTube, because you can always find us there at your listening leisure. Stars, likes, subscribes, all those things always help, so we appreciate them. I've been Ben Byrne, here with James Hake, Sean Merwin, Dale Kingsmill, and we'll be back next week for another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast.
Energy
down. The AI machine is using Ben as a battery. They've plugged him in.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't think they'd get much energy out of me, unfortunately.